Hey, folks, thanks for joining us on the extra little cold weather this morning, but that doesn't stop us over here at KRDO. We have such a special show planned for you. We have Bill Roach, a World War II veteran, who will be joining us today. And then we're also starting with our hometown hero that is brought to you by Marigolds. We do that every week, and we offer a $100 gift card to a veteran or an active duty service member. Do we have Rob on the line? Rob, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Good morning.
Hey, Rob, fantastic. I know you're currently out at Peterson Air Force Base overseeing the management service of the Chinooks out there. And I know you have a lot of military time as well, and we just wanted to say thank you for that. And how long have you served?
Oh, so I'm actually overseeing the contract out here at Fort Carson, Butts Army Airfield.
Okay, gotcha.
For the 4th Combat Aviation Brigade. But I've served, counting my military time and civilian service for more than 30 years.
That's fantastic. Good for you. Thank you so much for your service. And so you're currently out there right now at Fort Carson, and then you were at, prior service was in the Army, I believe.
Yes, it was. 26 years, 11 months, and 7 days, not that I'm counting.
Well, good for you. We just wanted to bring you on there and say thank you so much for your service to our country. And we're going to get you in contact with Ghassan, the owner of Marigolds. He's going to have you up there, give you a $100 gift card. You can enjoy a nice meal up at Marigolds.
Well, I appreciate it. I appreciate everything you do, and I appreciate everything that all service members and vets do for us as well. It's awesome.
Hey, thanks, Rob. You enjoy your weekend, okay?
All right, you too. Thank you.
All right, folks, there's our hometown hero of the week. And now we have the honor of speaking with Bill Roach. Bill, how are you this morning?
Well, kind of chilly.
I know. It is a big change in the weather.
Yeah, no, other than that, I'm doing fine. Yeah.
Fantastic. And Bill, how long have you been here in Colorado Springs?
Well, we moved back here. I was here before. I was taught, at the academy. But I moved back here permanently in 83. I've been here since 83, yeah.
That's first quite 30, a while. Yeah, you've seen a lot of change here.
Yeah, quite a bit, yeah.
That's fantastic. And so we're bringing you on today because you're a World War II veteran. You've had a lot of time in service, a lot you did after that as well. But just want to talk about how you got involved in World War II and what that looked like.
Well, and I got out of high school kind of early for some reason. I went to a Catholic school. It was a Latin school. And I graduated from high school when I was 15. So
wow.
This was 1940. And so, what the hell am I going to do at 15 years old? Anyway,
that's pretty early to graduate.
I did get a job in Lexington, Kentucky, where I'm from Lexington, actually. I got a job at the Lafayette Hotel there and working at the desk, handing keys back to people and checking the mail and stuff like that. And then they organized a military facility in Lexington called the Lexington Signal Depot. And I got a job out there when I was still 17 and stayed out there until... When the war started in 1941, I think everybody, I was 18 years old then. I was 18 in 1942. When was I born? 24. I was born in 24. So anyway, I was pretty ready for the military. I wasn't quite eligible for the draft, but I was 18 years old. And I worked at this signal depot for a while. And then my brother first went into the Army Air Force. In those days, it was everybody says Army Air Corps. It wasn't the Army Air Corps. The Army Air Corps went out of existence in 1941. And after that, it became the Army Air Force. Anyway, I decided that... I'd follow his footsteps. He volunteered, and I said, well, I'm 18 years old, so I'll volunteer. Everybody that I knew was getting ready to go into the military after Pearl Harbor. I mean, that was the thing that got everybody excited back in those days. I mean, the fact that we were attacked by the Japanese. And so everybody was down at the recruiting station trying to get into the Air Force rather than waiting to be drafted into the Army.
Yeah.
So I got in, and the procedure then was to send you to Mississippi, Keesler Field. And so I went down there for my basic training on June the 8th, 43. And went through that in the summertime. If you've ever been in Biloxi, Mississippi in the summer.
I assume it's pretty humid.
It's very humid, very hot, yeah. And it's about a six-week course, 6 to 8 weeks. And it was a aviation cadet type program. We were going to be pilots. Everybody was going to be a pilot. That was the idea. And so they sent us after this to a college. We went to various colleges all over the U.S. It had been set up programs. They sent me to Elon College, North Carolina. That was after I finished my basic training. And we were at Elon studying some things like, not astro, but meteorology and some subjects that you would actually go to in college, because most of us were just high school graduates. And normally the aviation cadet program, you had to be a college graduate, but during the war, they lowered their standards because they didn't have all these college graduates that were eager to jump into an airplane. So,
yeah.
So went through that at Elon College. That's it's a nice school. It still is down there in North Carolina. And when we finished that, they sent us down to Nashville, Tennessee to decide whether we were going to be pilots, bombardiers, or navigators. There were those three. And there were 50 of us in my class, and we went down there. Well, this happened to be toward the end of 43, and the 8th Air Force over in England was suffering heavy casualties at this time. I mean, really heavy casualties. And so when a B-17 or a B-24 was shot down, you lost two pilots, but you lost five gunners. So guess who they wanted? They wanted gunners.
Yeah, yeah.
So out of my 50 class that we were all headed to be pilots, we never got to pilot training. We were all washed out at this so-called classification center in Nashville, and we were sent to different technical schools. The gunners, if you went to a technical school, you either went to Keesler Field, Mississippi for aviation mechanics, and you became the engineer on the 17. You usually, you flew it with the top turret. You were a top turret gunner, but you were also the engineer.
Okay.
Then they had the radio operators, and they sent them to Scottsville, Illinois, and they had armorers. And these were right up here at Buckley Field, and that's where I went.
That's too funny.
So they shipped me up to Buckley. And Buckley Field in World War II was a big basic training center. Most people don't realize that, but they had about 20,000 troops up there during the war in 1943 and 44. But they also had this armament school because Lowry, which was the actual school, was overflowing, and they needed more facilities, so they had a course out at Buckley Field. So I don't know if you ever heard of the movie actor John Payne.
You ever hear
of John Payne? He's an old timer, but you'll still see him in the movies. He was our PT instructor.
Okay, really?
Yeah, he was one of our PT instructors because we had several. We had another guy there, Johnny Murtaugh, who was a big league baseball player. I mean, really big league. He was well known back before the war, before 42. Anyway, it was a good course. We learned to operate everything from small caliber weapons all the way up to 75-millimeter cannon. You didn't realize that some airplanes carried the 75-millimeter cannon. Actually, they did, but the only one that could do that was the B-25.
Okay.
And they tried that experiment it was an experiment, but we had to learn how to take it apart and everything else because of armament. And so we went through this armament school all the way in the, we got there in January 44 and left there, I think, in July. And in July, we went to a gunnery school.
And where was that located?
This was at Fort Myers.
Okay.
It's actually the International Airport at Fort Myers today was the Army Air Base back during the war.
Okay.
And it was a gunnery school. And gunnery was a lot of fun. You know, they let you shoot all those weapons.
Yeah, I'm sure it was.
And we didn't actually get into the B-17s, though, at gunnery school. They had AT-6s and also the course basically... They had one course where you got on a like a racetrack, and you stood in the back of a pickup truck with a metal circle to keep you from falling off, yeah. And you had a shotgun.
No kidding.
And as it was skeet. They had 25 stations, and this car would go about 10 miles an hour, and you had to—you didn't know where the bird was coming from, you know, on skeet.
Yeah.
It might come this way. It was to treat, you know, tell your reflexes to see how you could follow. So that was the fun part.
It sounds like fun.
But basically, you know, the B-17s and B-24s, they all use 50 caliber machine guns. So we concentrated on the 50 caliber practicing firing and so forth. After gunnery school, we went across the bay, Tampa Bay, to MacDill Field. Well, we picked up a crew, I should say. At this time, when you go to gunnery school, you're an individual. You know, you're not associated with any crew or anything.
Okay.
And we went to, it was called Plant Park in Florida. Actually, it was a field where the Major League Baseball teams used to practice.
No kidding.
And we stayed in the grandstands. We slept underneath the grandstands.
Wow.
For about a week while we were forming a crew. That's where you formed your crew, was at Plant Park, Florida. And once you got your crew together, they shipped you over to MacDill Air Force. It still exists, MacDill, right in Tampa, near Tampa. And that's where you meet your B-17, you know, and the crew gets together with the airplane. And so we practice flying and different types of maneuvers with the whole crew together at MacDill for quite a while. Matter of fact, we had a big hurricane when we were there in 1944.
Really?
November 44, yeah, Tampa was hit pretty hard. We were sleeping in these tar paper barracks, you know how then during the war they had these little shacks made out of tar paper, and that's where we lived. There were no windows, no glass or anything. You had an opening, and you had a piece of wood that closed, and you fastened it. That was to keep the rain or whatever out.
Yeah.
But when this hurricane was over, all those little huts were just gone. The palm trees were down. When they had us stay in the hangar. They had a big hangar there at MacDill.
Okay.
So they moved everybody into the hangar overnight during when the hurricane hit. You can check the records back in November 44, and it was just like this last one. Not as bad as this last one, of course.
Yeah.
Well, after we finished our training at MacDill, our crew was ready to go, so they shipped us up to Hunter Field, Georgia.
Okay.
Hunter Field was where they gave us all of our equipment, our helmets and parachutes, and if you were lucky, you got an airplane. You know, if they had B-17s, you could fly over.
Okay.
Well, when we went through, there weren't any airplanes available, so they shipped us up to Camp Kilmer, New Jersey, which was the port of embarkation.
Okay.
And you had to wait for a ship. So we were up there in the New York area for a couple of weeks waiting for a convoy. Over then, in those days, they went in convoys.
Okay.
And you had to wait until the convoy was formed. We had, I don't know how many, we had 20, 30 ships in our convoy.
Wow.
But we went in a big ship called the Ile-de-France, which was a French cruise liner before the war.
Okay.
And it was a pretty good ship, but when you jam about 6,000,
it gets a little tight.
Yeah, we were way down at about the fourth level down below on the deck. And it took us 10 days to get across because they had to zigzag because of submarines. And this was in November of 44.
Okay. And where did you go into from there?
We went straight to England. I think we docked in Scotland, but got on a train. And there were, on this ship that we went over, there was a lot of air crews. I don't know how many, but, maybe 30, 40, and 10-man crews. So a lot of guys.
Uh-huh.
And then when they got over there, they divided them. And they had just had, 8th Air Force had just had a big loss over Merseburg. I think they lost about 30 planes one day. But anyway, they were running short of crews. So they sent crews to different bases depending on replacements, what they needed, and all over England. And we ended up with the 452nd Bomb Group. My crew ended up with the 452nd Bomb Group, which was up at a place called Defham Green, which is really not a city. It's a hole in it's a signpost. But it's out in the country. Most of those bases in England that we flew from in World War II were all in East Anglia.
Okay.
And by the end of the war, we had, the 8th Air Force had 40.
We're going to go to a quick break, Bill, and we're going to come right back. Very interesting topics here as we talk with Bill Roach, World War II veteran. Thanks for joining us on The Extra. Folks, thanks for sticking with us. A very special show we have here. We're with Bill Roach, a B-17 World War II veteran. Bill, thanks for coming on the show.
Okay, well, I should explain that everybody might think I'm a pilot, but I wasn't. I was a waist gunner, and my rank was staff sergeant. And we arrived in England in November, late November of 44. And we were assigned to the 452nd Bomb Group, which was at Defham Green. 452nd had gone overseas in January 44. And they got there just in time for Big Week, which was a period when the 8th Air Force was involved in getting us ready for the invasion in June. But anyway, they had heavy losses in that part of, in the early part of 44 and before D-Day. Anyway, the 452nd was a group. The groups in England in those days, the 8th Air Force had four squadrons.
Okay.
They had a lot of support groups there, a lot of support units there that supported the combat units. They had ordnance, intelligence, medical, and so forth. So there were quite a lot of people. Average 8th Air Force base had probably about 2,500 to about 3,000 people.
Okay.
And so that's it. And the squadron, each squadron, when they went on combat, would put up 12 airplanes. So we never flew four squadrons at one time. We always flew three, keeping one squadron in reserve. And so when we go on a maximum mission, we'd have about 36 bombers from each bomb group. And the 8th Air Force, by the time the war was over, had over 40 bomb groups. So you can imagine we had missions with over 1,000 bombers. We had two Medal of Honor winners in my bomb group.
Okay.
Both of them posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor. I can't go into the details because it would take the whole hour here.
That's okay. And so you got over there, and do you remember did you go right away into flying your first mission?
Well, the way they worked, you had to fly practice missions. So My pilot had to have a combat mission flying as a co-pilot before he could take his own crew over on a combat mission. Well, unfortunately, my pilot got involved with the mission he flew got shot down. So we were delayed. This was during the Battle of the Bulge.
Okay.
In December of 44. And fortunately, he did get back to England. They crashed in somewhere in the front lines, and the American Army was there. They gave him a couple of rifles. It was a blizzard going, as you probably remember. Mm-hmm. The winter of that year was one of the worst in Europe, and the Battle of the Bulge was fought in a lot of snow and ice. And anyway, they were in Germany they were in Belgium, I guess it was, for about a week before they could get back to England.
Okay.
So when they came back, we had to fly some more practice missions before we actually went on combat. So we flew our first combat mission in January. The entire crew got together in January. But we've been flying practice missions and over.
Where was that mission too? Your first one?
You know, I know, but I can't remember.
That's okay. No worries.
How many
missions total?
I only flew nine okay. missions. We were shot down on our sixth mission. I know the target there. It was Chemnitz. And it was a tough time. We lost four planes on that mission. Well, I say lost. They were missing in action, and mm-hmm. we don't know what happened to a couple of them. The 8th Air Force lost 28,000 men killed, you know, which is a tremendous amount, and probably more than that were POWs. So we had over 50,000 casualties.
And you said you were shot down twice.
Yeah, the Chemnitz mission, which was on the 6th of February, 45, was when we were shot down the first time. And we crash-landed in near the village of Ossigny, which is south of Orleans, France, about 60 miles. But fortunately for us, it was liberated France.
Yeah.
Because we were trying to get to Brussels. There was an emergency field in Brussels.
Okay.
And we had lost an engine, and we were having a lot of trouble. We couldn't keep up with the formation. So the formation left, and we were flying on our own. And the pilot thought he was headed for Brussels, but he wasn't headed for Brussels. And so we ran out of fuel, and we had to crash land the airplane in a field in France about like I mentioned, near the village of Ossigny. Mm-hmm. And so we were, because this was liberated France, there was a troop carrier group that was not very far from where we crashed. It was down, it was near Orleans. And so they flew us back to England in a C-47 about 10 days later. I mean, by the time we got everything settled, like, they were trying to do something with the airplane, but they had to abandon it and strip it. They couldn't salvage it.
Couldn't salvage it.
It was badly damaged. When you crash land a B-17, you have to drop the ball turret.
Okay.
You know, with your wheels up, because you're coming in on your belly. Mm-hmm. And if you left the ball turret there, when the plane hit, it would nose over immediately. So what happens in the crash landing is the crew usually gathers in the radio room, which is a small room in the middle of the plane, and the two pilots and the engineer are up front. Well, in our case, it's a good thing the engineer was up front, because our electrical system had been shot out and they couldn't operate the flaps on the plane for landing. So he had to crank them manually.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He cranked the flaps manually to get us down to the ground. And so we came in. We were all in the back, huddled for a crash landing. And of course, when you drop the ball turret, there's a huge hole in the middle of the airplane.
Yeah.
So we hit the side of this hill, and the mud and everything was snowing and raining, and the mud came up through the through that hole, yeah. Right next to the radio room. So anyway, we were lucky. Nobody was hurt, but the plane was ruined.
And so when you got back, did you start flying right away again?
Well, yeah, it didn't take us long. Yeah. We got back. We got shot down again the same month. I mean, we got shot down on the 6th of February, and then on the 26th of February, we flew five missions. After we got shot down in France, we flew, no, not five. It must have been four. Anyway, it was the Berlin mission on the 26th. And this, you know, everybody talks about shot down. There's two types of being shot down. One's an emergency landing, and one's a crash landing. And they're different.
Okay.
The second time when we went headed east to get behind them, you know, before we started the mission to Berlin, we were briefed that if you run into trouble, you should immediately head east. Don't try to come back to England because you're not going to make it. And that's what happened to us. We tried to follow our formation. Fortunately, we had an escort of P-51s that were right above it, about 12 of them, the whole squadron. And they flew with us for about 20 minutes, trying to get us to turn west. They thought we were lost.
Yeah.
But we were deliberately headed east because we knew we'd never get back to England. So we kept flying until we almost ran out of fuel. And then when the pilot came down, we could see hills that were higher than we were. So he said, we better get down fast. Mm-hmm. And so he found a level spot. Well, it wasn't very level when we got there. But it was behind. We could see the front lines. We could see the Soviet convoys and everything. But we came down in a meadow right outside of Krakow, Poland, about not very far from Auschwitz.
Really?
You know, Auschwitz is located near Krakow. And it's a village called Lischke. And this was at an emergency landing. It wasn't a crash.
Okay.
We did a nice meadows. It looked like a nice meadow from altitude. But when we got down there, we could see it. We could see a Russian airplane that had crashed in this same meadow.
Wow.
But anyway, we went with wheels down because we thought, well, we'll get the plane repaired. We didn't want to spend the rest of the war with the Russians. So we said, we're going to get the plane repaired and we'll fly it back out of here. Well, that never happened, of course. As soon as we landed, of course, the Russians took over everything. And it was a pretty good landing, actually. And I've got pictures here to show you the plane. It's still in good condition, perfect.
And unbelievable you brought those in.
But what they did, we had a big party up until about midnight with the Soviets. And we'd been flying since early morning, you know, since about 5 o'clock in the morning. So we were all pooped. Well, we spent several days there in the rectory of a Catholic church in this village of Lischke. And then they moved us to a Soviet, it's like a motor pool right behind the front lines. And we could see a lot of fight. We couldn't see, but we could hear a lot of noise, a lot of fighting. And at night, you could see the flashing of artillery and everything. Mm-hmm. So they had liberated Krakow on 26th of January, and we went down on 26th of February, which was a month later. But they hadn't gone much further past Krakow. They had liberated Auschwitz also.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
well,
so
anyway,
where did,
I could
where,
go.
Where did you get located after that? How'd you make it back?
Well, they kept us there in this this sort of motor pool thing under modest guards. I mean, we were free to go outside and things like that. Mm-hmm. We were in a, I wouldn't call it a barracks because it was just it was a Polish place that the Russians had taken over. Well, I tell you a funny thing about the Russians. They didn't know what to do with us. That was the main thing. You know, we were a pain in the neck. They could have shipped us up to Poltava in the Ukraine because we had an air base up there. We used Poltava for shuttle missions. and it was in western Ukraine. The big problem there was that we had a shuttle mission in July of 44, and we landed our planes there at Poltava. Poltava was a Soviet air base, but okay. They had given us permission to use it as a refueling and shuttle there and bomb Germany and go back and so forth. That's a long story about the shuttle, but shuttles, it was called Operation Frantic. But anyway, when we landed, after we bombed Germany, when I say we, I wasn't on this mission. Mm-hmm. When they bombed Germany and they landed at Poltava to refuel and go back, the Germans spotted us landing there. We had three groups, a wing, three bomb groups. So that's a lot of airplanes. That's about over 100 planes. And the P-51s that were our escorts, they went to a different Soviet air base called Mirgorod, which was further inland. But this German observation plane spotted us landing. So that night, the Germans came over with bombers and bombed all of our airplanes on the ground. We lost the whole squadrons of planes. They were all destroyed.
Wow.
On the ground. A lot of Russians were killed. I think 10 Americans were killed during this bombing. And it was because the Soviets wouldn't let us bring in any anti-aircraft or anything or any radar to protect our... They said, oh, we'll protect you. Well, by the time the Germans had finished bombing, the Soviet aircraft just got out. They couldn't do anything. I mean, the bombers were gone.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's another little-known fact.
That's unbelievable.
So a lot of planes lost on the ground. I mean, a lot of planes, about 60.
Wow. And so what? How did you get back after
that? Well, they got back through Egypt and all kinds. You can read all kinds of stories how they got back. You know, back during the war, we had Air Transport Command. You could go to Africa and Egypt and Casablanca and places like that and get back to England.
And so did you make it back to your base eventually?
I wasn't on that mission.
Okay, but no, how did you get back to your base?
Oh, when I got back. Uh-huh. Well, I didn't finish that story. They shipped us out of Poland. We were in Poland near Krakow. And they shipped us down to Kiev.
Okay.
They had a camp set up in Kiev. It wasn't a camp. It was a big building, a big bombed-out building. And there were 75 of us there. These were crews that had been shot down all over East Europe. A couple of RAF guys. We even had two Tuskegee Airmen there,
really?
Believe it or not. They were 15th Air Force, you know. They were flying out of Italy. Well, the story was that this one guy had a bullet hole in his gas tank, and his wingman had nothing wrong with his P-51. The two of them landed Bucharest at the airport. The Russians had liberated, I keep saying liberated, but anyway, the Russians had occupied Romania by this time. They had liberated that part of East Europe. And so when they landed at Bucharest, they grabbed their two P-51s and shipped them to this camp. So you wouldn't believe it. We had one gunner had his arm shot off, and he was in a sleeping bag, and their plane had been shot down by the Soviets. And one of the gunners was killed, and one of them was wounded, and they were shot down over Bulgaria. And so they're shipping all these guys that are in Eastern Europe. They didn't know what to do with them.
Uh-huh.
So they're shipping them all to this one location right outside of Kiev, north of Kiev. When I was an air attaché in Moscow, I was there in Moscow for a couple of years. I went into the Ukraine and went down to where I thought we were, but I couldn't find a place. But it was on the road to Vienna from outside north of Kiev, about 20 kilometers outside of town.
Okay.
And anyway, they kept us there and with guards with bayonets and trying to feed us fish heads and things like that. Fish heads are pretty good, incidentally. A lot of protein.
Okay, Bill, we're going to have you back on again for another show because you got a wealth of information, and we really appreciate your service and you being willing to share those stories with us.
Well, I'm willing to share them because that's all I remember.
All right, folks, thanks for joining us on The Extra. You have a great weekend.